Back together again, you and I wrapping up a busy week, Friday, May the 10th, 2024 on Connecticut Today, as we welcomed author Eric J. Dolan, his new book, Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. And of course, former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso stopped by with his weekly wrap-up, looking at the just-concluded General Assembly session in Hartford. Every so often, we should learn something, right? I love to have authors on who write new books, and if I think something is fascinating for me, I hope it'll be fascinating enough for you too, especially when it comes to history. We think we know history, and we don't, because all these interesting stories pop up, and you say, well, wow, I never knew about that, and I got a pitch for this book, Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. The author Eric J. Dolan has written numerous books. He's called one of the finest writers today about ships and the sea, according to the folks at American Heritage, which is no small feat there to get praise from them. That's a great magazine. He is an award-winning author of numerous books concentrating on maritime history, including Leviathan, Rebels at Sea, and Black Flags, Blue Waters. He lives in a beautiful area of New England, Marblehead, Massachusetts. Eric J. Dolan is the guest. Hey, Eric, it's Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very, very well. Thanks for dropping by, Eric. Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. Just to give listeners here one line of the summary here. The true story, folks, get this, of five castaways abandoned on the Falkland Islands during the War of 1812, a tale of treachery, shipwreck, isolation, and the desperate struggle for survival. And Eric, I'm guessing cell service wasn't really good out there at the time, was it? No?
No. They were all alone on the Falkland Islands. Actually, the Falkland Islands are 700 islands, and if you add up all the land area, it's roughly equal to the state of Connecticut.
Wow. And of course, present day, we remember the last couple of encounters with the Falkland Islands, but I have read in the past that the dispute over the islands and their position on the earth and where they were had a big bearing on a lot of other historical things, including what you write about. So tell us a little about this book and the story that I knew nothing about, and I'm sure a lot of other people don't either.
Yeah, I knew nothing about it before I was writing the book. Fascinating story. It's basically a story of three ships, an American sealing vessel, that's a vessel killing seals to sell their pelts in China, a shipwrecked British brig, and a British warship, all coming together on the Falkland Islands during the War of 1812. And a lot of bad things happen. Some good things happen. Mm-hmm. But essentially, in a nutshell, the American sealers, there are 13 of them, they come upon the 54 shipwrecked British individuals who are going from Australia to London. The Americans, even though it's wartime, yeah, and Britain is our enemy, the Americans agree in a humanitarian gesture to save, to rescue the castaways and bring them back to South America so they can make it on to England. And all they ask for is salvage rights to the wreck. So that's great. Everybody's getting along great. But what happens is right before the Americans discovered these shipwreck people, six of them went off in a 17.5-foot boat and traveled 1,200 miles over the ocean to Buenos Aires to get help from the British Navy. And the British Navy sent a warship. So when this warship comes, the captain of the warship, this guy Duranda, he says, I don't care about this wonderful agreement that you reached with the Americans, that they were going to save you, that they were trying to do the right thing. He rips up the agreement. He takes the American ship, the Nanina, as a prize of war, and he imprisons all, or he makes all of the Americans prisoners of war. And then the other main part of the story, I mean, there are a lot of twists.
Oh, my God, yeah.
The other main part of the story is that five men, two Americans and three British, including the captain of the sealing vessel, are intentionally marooned when the British warship and its prize leaves the Falkland Islands. And those men survive for 534 days before they're rescued by two British whale ships that just happened to come by the Falklands.
Oh my God! Oh jeez! There's Eric. There's like four miniseries here in this whole thing. I mean, honest to God, yeah. Get the casting agents on here. All right, millions of things through my head here again. Name of the book: Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. Now you talk about a British brig ship. So those are prisoners, right or wrong?
Not all of them, but a good number of them. There were 54 people on board,
yeah,
including the crew. There were 13 armed Royal Marines,
yeah,
and then 10 of the people were former convicts. Because, as you know, Australia was a penal colony,
yeah.
And four of those convicts were former prostitutes, which is a little twist.
By the way,
sorry about that.
By the way, wow. Okay, so now this is the War of 1812. So obviously, you know, we can do the math. So you mentioned in your opening there that somebody went back and traveled 1,200 miles and came back. So how long did that little leg of the junket take?
Well, that took a better part of a month. They had some rough weather. But they almost got totaled by a whale that came by and just missed their boat out in the middle of the ocean. But they finally made it, and it was an amazing voyage. It's not quite as great as Captain Bligh's voyage after Mutiny on the Bounty, but it was very impressive with rudimentary navigational equipment and going from the Falklands to Buenos Aires, essentially, a very dangerous trek.
So no ocean-bound GPS, I guess.
No.
So these guys are navigating what? Sextants and the stars, right? What else could they do?
No, mainly a compass. Their main guide, actually. One of the guys on board was a former transport captain. So he took a number of ships down to Australia from England of convicts, and he was a very seasoned mariner. So he was able to use celestial navigation, looking at the sky at night when it wasn't too cloudy, and a compass, and he roughly made his way.
So how long did it take you, A, to do this, and B, how difficult was it? I mean, I assume that some of this stuff was written about by the survivors, or was it not? What was left of the accounts of this, and how long did it take you to piece this all thing together?
Yeah, if there weren't primary accounts, I wouldn't have written the book. Basically, Charles Barnard, the captain of the sailing vessel, he wrote a book about his experience in 1829. A bunch of other people who were either British or American either kept logbooks during this event, wrote about it later, or what really helped me is that there was a formal protest lodged by the Americans about this abysmal treatment from the British that went to the U.S. State Department, which is a very long document. That plus a court case that took place in London after this to determine if the Nanina was a valid prize. The court case has a lot of records attached to it, and I was able to get those from the National Archives of England. So, and beyond that, of course, newspapers at the time when these Americans started straggling back, newspapers ran this story all over the place about basically another example of how horrific the British were. And this is still in the midst of the war. And, they just couldn't imagine any other country but the British treating other human beings so horribly after they had lent out the hand of help.
And this all in a time where, you know, some British or American family is reading about this, and I'm sure in those papers of the day, they said, oh, by the way, you know, 4 months ago or 5 months ago, you know, somebody came back, and we may hear from them in a few months. So not exactly instant communication, huh?
No. It is it takes a long time back in the early age of sail. And actually, the captain of the sealer, when he was rescued in 1814, he didn't actually make it back to New York, his home, until about 1816, because he had to go along with this whale ship into the Pacific, and he ended up going to Peru, Canton, Hawaii, before he could finally hop a ship back to the United States.
It's amazing. Eric, what lessons can we take out of something like this that seems to have so many moving parts? I mean, for me, Eric, I look at this stuff just on a surface level here, and I've read a few sections of your book saying, hey, there was life, there were interpersonal relationships, there was navigating, there was getting things done a long time before the phone I'm holding in my hand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What they did was, it really took a lot of guts to get in a boat and go out in the open ocean, go, 3 or 4 months sail to get to someplace. It really is amazing. But the broader lessons, I mean, the main lesson, and I'm sure it's a lesson, but the main thing that I want people to get from the book is actually an enjoyable read. I know that sounds a little bit trite, but you do get insights into human nature. You see people acting nobly and horrifically under times of duress in this state of war. You see what people being bullies, people being magnanimous, people being courteous to each other, and everything in between. So it's sort of as a broad survey of human nature. And then on top of it, it's just a rip-roaring maritime tale.
So how's the screenplay coming along, and who are you going to cast in this whole thing? Come on.
I have no idea, but you are about the 30th person that has mentioned this needs to be made.
Oh, come on. You and I can sit here and cast this thing, right? Let's see. DiCaprio, Johnny Depp, George Clooney. I mean, don't tell me this hasn't floated. Yeah, I know who could play that, right? Come on.
I would love that. But I want to mention one other thing
Before
we get off. Since you're in Bridgeport, I actually spent a lot of my youth in Stanford,
so not too far away. Really?
Yeah. From age 9 through high school. And then I went to one of my graduate schools that I went to. I went to the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, which is now the Yale School of the Environment. So I'm very familiar with Connecticut, and I'm actually going to be in Bridgeport a couple of weeks from now, actually next week, when I take the ferry over to Port Jefferson, right?
Bridgeport to Port Jefferson. About an hour and 20 minutes or so. And in fact, I'll be on that this weekend to see friends of mine on the island. So, that's cool. Sure. So you got a little of your early maritime indoctrination here along New Haven shoreline and Fairfield County shoreline then.
Absolutely. I used to love going down to Long Island Sound.
Excellent. Left for Dead is the book. Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World. It just came out 3 days ago, this past Tuesday. It's in hardcover. Pick it up Amazon.com, all the other places you get books, and it's getting some really good reviews on Amazon. So, Eric, thank you. Eric J. Dolan is the author and guest. Eric, thanks. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. There you go. How about that? Former Yale guy, former Fairfield County guy. I did not know that. Left for Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World, a local Connecticut author who has made well, Eric J. Dolan. We're joining us right now for his every Friday wrap-up, right around this time, 5:15 or so, a gentleman who knows the nooks and crannies of Bridgeport politics and all that. Chris Caruso joins us. Chris, how are you, sir? Chris, are you there?
I'm there, Paul.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Okay, how about you?
I'm good. I'm wondering if we should retitle this, because, you and I get into this stuff every week. I wonder if we could title this the Ajita Report. I got to see if the boss up front wants it. Would that be good?
It works for me.
And we could get, how about this, Chris? We could get Brioski to sponsor it. You see the tie-in there? You see?
Yeah, that's right. And we could have Lawrence Welk and
my God,
Guy Lombardo, and we'll be all set.
We'll be all set. All right, Chris, the dust is still settling up north. We have the announcement from Marilyn Monroe. So where would Marilyn Moore? I'm sure that's not the first time people have said that. Where do you want to start?
No. Go ahead. Well, Paul, let me start with the session.
Yeah.
Some of the things that were done this year, I never even saw any of things like that when I was up in the legislature.
Okay.
They put $3 million into the budget without any identifying factor of the $3 million. So where's the $3 million going to go? And apparently it's geared toward, workers who are on strike, that they receive striker benefits.
Oh, yeah.
But it was just kind of snuck in. And then there was another one which people don't realize. Under school construction, there was one sentence taken out of the legislation that For example, if you have a company that's overseeing those companies that are building a school, that company can actually bid on projects too.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons all that was changed was because of the John Rowland scandals and the state contractors. And so now it looks like they're going back to problems that we had before. It was just bizarre. And they snuck them into these bills that no one caught. And mm-hmm. then they were exposed. I just never saw that stuff before, Paul. And now it's the big ring dance. The governor is raising the absentee ballot bill.
Yeah.
And now it's going to clean elections. That's going to do nothing. It's absolutely going to do nothing. So I don't know. It was a bizarre session, to be honest with you. They made some moves in the budget. The mm-hmm. governor apparently went along with it. And then the governor vetoed the strike bill, that $3 million.
Yeah.
It's just odd. It's just, I've never seen the legislature operate in that way before.
Yeah.
There were things put into the implementer mm-hmm. bill over time, but not to that extent,
Yeah, and Chris, I applaud the governor, and I said this a lot on my show, and I took calls on it. I was chatting with folks on social media last night. I applaud the governor for saying, I'm not really warm, because he said he's one of the six union lovers in Greenwich, but he said I'm not really warm to giving benefits to strikers. But Chris, I applauded him because he said, but it was the process that he really didn't like, and I think he's right, Chris. If you want to do this, then you introduce a bill that says we want X amount of money for striking private sector workers, and gosh darn it, Chris, you do it that way. You don't do this stuff at the 11th hour out of an office of a constitutional officer, and then you rename the fund? I mean, come on. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, and then you give the $3 million falls under the comptroller, and the comptroller has to figure out what to do with it. And he even is in doubt. He says, I'd like to solve problems. So now he's going to meet to solve a $3 million problem.
Chris, let me ask you, how does that happen? I mean, the governor is the CEO and the House Speaker and the Senate President. And then when you put a microphone in front of their face, Chris, and say, who came up with it? Well, it was kind of, they know, Chris. They're just trying to cover themselves.
Oh, yeah. It was very clear. The $3 million was put in by Matthew Ritter, the Speaker of the House, and Marty Looney, the President of the Senate. They didn't hide it. They put it in. They were asked about it, and they said, Ritter was more kind of evasive about it, saying, mm-hmm. It's $3 million. We didn't earmark it for anything in particular. But Marty Looney came out and said, no, it's for the strikers. he was very positive about it, as a matter of fact. So that's what was unusual. I've seen leadership over the year make decisions and all, but not something like this, just to insert $3 million. And then, frankly, the Republican side didn't even fight it. There was no argument. So probably the Republicans got something out of it. There was probably a deal mm-hmm. that, we'll turn our head on this if you give us that. And, I think the effectiveness of Governor Lamont is he doesn't veto everything. So when he does say he's going to veto something, it has power to it. And he is right. There's a process. I'm not going to get on the side of the strikers or against the strikers. I think, that's the merits of the discussion,
mm-hmm.
In a debate. But there should be a process. That's the only fair way to do it, is a process where it can be aired and then, brought out, to the legislature for decision making. But I just noticed even with the construction bill, of state contractors, and there was the chairman of the committee wanted that taken out. So they took it out, and there was no hearing or anything. So, how fair is that, especially the corruption that we've seen and the scandals we've seen? That's why that legislation was put in. So now we're just like pulling it out as we go along, which is always dangerous. And then the bill with absentee ballots does nothing. There's nothing in there that's going to curb the abuse that we've seen.
Mm.
So, it was just bizarre in certain, frankly, the session, there were some good things.
They sure.
Some legislation on nursing homes, and which I think is critically important. There were some things on that. The other thing, one piece of legislation had within the bonding package was money for a church where one of the legislators is the pastor. It's like, oh, and, you know, years ago that would have never been done.
Yeah.
And it just, it's become so blatant, Paul, that I don't understand it. Maybe it's our world and I'm not moving with it the way I should or something. But
And Chris, the ironic thing is years ago, when it wasn't done, there was a lot of stuff that got through because people kind of weren't paying attention or whatever. But this is, I keep telling people, this is not 1970 anymore. The common person, Chris Caruso, can listen to talk radio. They can follow these bills online.
Yeah.
They know who votes. Heck, they can download a PDF of the bill, and if they're really bored one night and their wife's already asleep, they can read the bills. I mean, it's amazing some of the possible sleaze that goes on. I mean, don't they realize, hey, people are not as disconnected anymore as they used to be?
No. Well, you know, and every politician, I think every politician should use as their middle name transparent.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be the word, transparent.
Yeah.
And yet when it comes to transparency, they're not being transparent. That's what's so bizarre, Paul. I couldn't get over some of the stuff. And if these are good ideas, then they should go through the process. And, you know, if they're good ideas, they'll survive and they'll be passed. If they're not, they'll be defeated. But some of this stuff can be very dangerous when one or two legislators decide to insert something. That's the danger part of it, you know?
Yeah. Chris, in the couple of minutes we have left, a close friend of yours, a confidant, Marilyn Moore, saying that at 75 she's done. That really does open up, Chris, a really maybe the most interesting legislative district in the state.
Yeah.
The 22nd district with a big chunk of Bridgeport, and an area with urban concerns. Trumbull, which, again, suburbia, most of it, and part of Monroe, too. So what do you think the realities are now for that? See, and I know the nominations have to come when? Tuesday night, I think?
I think the departure was planned by Senator Moore. I think she had been thinking about it for a while, and apparently she's calling on her successor. She would like to see an alderman from Bridgeport, former alderman, who moved from the South and into Black Rock and is eligible to run in this district, the 22nd senatorial. But then you also have former Mayor Bill Finch is running.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, he just called me today about it. And and then there's...
You see, Chris? They know where the power is, Chris.
I don't know. And then apparently a person in Trumbull, I think she may even be the town chair of the Trumbull Democratic Party, I think, is going to throw her hat in. And to even add more to this, Paul, you know, I'm a resident of the 22nd Senatorial District, and people are asking me to run. So who knows?
Wait a minute now. Who knows? Is that now? Wait a minute, Chris. I have to wait a minute. Hold it. I got to put on my journalistic hat here. So for the next few seconds, we're not friends anymore, Chris. Mr. Caruso, will you? Are you considering a run, Mr. Caruso? Yes or no?
Well, let me see. How would the politicians answer that? Well, you never say no.
There you go. All right.
No.
Hey.
So it's gonna, and I'm not saying I'm running, Paul. People have, you know, called me and things like that. But it's going to be an interesting race, and there's probably going to be a lot of people in it. I don't even know if anyone would get the endorsement Tuesday night because there seems to be a lot of people in the race. So it's going to be an interesting race, though, to say the least. And it always happens whenever you have a sitting senator step out. You know, that's an open seat, and it becomes very, popular. People want to jump into it, you know?
Yeah. No, listen, Chris, I know you're not running because you have your eyes set. You have your eyes set on the governor's mansion.
There you go. And as long as you run as lieutenant governor,
How about that? Put the Pisons in Hartford. We'll get it done.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Would they talk then, Paul?
Yeah. Our slogan in 2026 will be, Oofa, Stuna.
Yes.
Anyway, hey, Chris, thanks. Yeah. Have a great weekend. Appreciate it.
You too, Paul.
Thanks. Take care. All right. I don't know. Did Mr. Caruso actually say no? I don't know. Imagine Chris and I running for governor. Two Italians. There we go. No Stunads. 2026. All right.